Okay, well, it got really quiet, so I'll go ahead and introduce today's speaker, Daniel Matute. I'm really excited that he's here. He got his PhD with Jerry Coyne, the University of Chicago, and is one of only four students that Jerry Coyne had over his entire illustrious career. He then went on to do a postdoc with Molly Schworsky at the University of Chicago, and just 6 months ago started as an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He won this year's Dobzhansky Prize from the Society for the Study of Evolution in recognition of his accomplishments and promise as an outstanding young evolutionary biologist. And with that, I'll take it away.
Thank you very much, Mary. I am really excited to be here. It has been a really fun couple of days, and I still have some more fun coming along. I want to tell you about a project that we started about two and a half years ago, and that essentially we just stumbled upon. For most of my young career, I have always thought that most species actually form where one species splits into two. And for the most part, what we think is occurring is that one ancestral population gets split into two by either geographical or environmental accidents, and over time, these two nascent species are going to accumulate genetic differences that over time are going to make them not only morphologically different, not only different, in some cases morphologically different, but also going to make them reproductively isolated from each other. Speciation is a process that is actually difficult to study because you really don't know whether it has ensued or not. The moment in which you test whether speciation has actually happened is when the two species that are putatively isolated have the chance to actually get in contact with each other and to actually interbreed with each other. And this is the point where we can ask whether reproductive isolation, either mechanism like behavioral or phosphatic isolation, has already occurred. It is not uncommon that when these nascent species actually come into contact, they are going to produce hybrids here represented by a yellow fly, and this fly with wings in spotting your wings that are going to show the hybrids might show some traits that are intermediate or that are aberrant and are not present in the parental species. And for the most part, a large portion of my research program is trying to identify what genes actually make these hybrids have either be inviable or sterile or fully adapted to the niches in which their parentals actually thrive. Hybrids are important because they are essentially a bridge between parental species, and they are allowed for gene flow between parentals and may actually generate the possibility of integration that might also act as a raw material for adaptation. Besides the possibility of one species splitting into two, there is a little bit of a more controversial mechanism that can also give rise to the species that is called hybrid speciation, in which the two parental species produce a hybrid that is viable, fertile, that occupies its own ecological niche, but importantly, is reproductively isolated from the two parentals. There are two types of hybrid speciations. Those that actually involve changes in ploidy, either by duplication of chromosomes, and in that particular case, if you have two species that are actually have different number of chromosomes and the hybrid also has a different number of chromosomes, for example, if it's intermediate, you can actually envision reproductive isolation occurring almost immediately because of non-disjunction in the meiosis. Or a different possibility is that the hybrid actually has the same ploidy as the parents, but there are traits that are unique to the hybrids that are actually ensuing reproductive isolation. So after actually checking out how common are these cases, and for this particular talk, I am going to focus on cases of hybrid speciation that involve no ploidy changes. So the ploidy of the hybrids is essentially the same as the parents. And over the last 10 years, there has been an explosion of cases of putative hybrid speciation. They seem to be everywhere. They seem to be pretty much present in any taxa that you look around. So they are in butterflies, they are in microorganisms, they are in fish, and the list honestly just keeps growing and growing. Last year, the group of Peter Agrofaro, led by Molly Schumer, actually published a really, really careful paper in which actually they assess what was the quality of these cases of putative hybrid speciation. And they actually tried to determine whether these cases were real or not.
And one of the cases, one of the observations that these authors came up with is that the majority of these cases of hybrid speciation, the support for this case of hybrid speciation comes from actually sequencing a series of organisms, a population, for example, and actually discover that they are the mixture of two different parentals. And these authors actually argue correctly that this genomic mosaicism can not only be caused by hybrid speciation, but that there are alternative processes that actually can give rise to these mixtures of genomes. First one, of course, is hybrid speciation, but for example, if you collect just a population of a hybrid swarm, just hybrids that are not reproductively isolated from the parentals, and you actually just look at the molecular data, you're going to possibly classify as a hybrid species if you don't have data of reproductive isolation. A third possibility is that actually you have my gene flow between one of the species here represented by this little tiny red dot from one of the species into the other one, and that particular organism is going to look like a mosaic. Nonetheless, it's going to not be reproductively isolated from the blue square here, and it doesn't really involve hybrid speciation. And a little bit of a more complicated case is over right here, in which this blue rectangle acquires reproductive isolation from this green rectangle, and then the green rectangle is receiving material from the red. So if you actually sample what is going on in the genome of this green with little red that looks like an olive, essentially you're going to find out that it looks like a mosaic, and that it's also retroactively isolated from the parentals, but hybrid speciation had nothing to do with the regulation of these organs. The second really useful thing that these authors did was to actually come up with a list. What was the bar to actually fulfill a case of hybrid speciation? The first one, of course, is that the organism must have hybrid gene. It must have been arisen through hybrid speciation. The second one is that reproductive isolation must exist between the hybrids and the parentals. And the third one that is really difficult to demonstrate is that the reproductive isolating mechanisms must be the result of a mixture. They must have originated after hybridization or during hybridization and not before. And when actually you do a meta analysis, actually finding out how many cases of hybrid speciation fulfill these three parameters or the three of them at the same time, they found that the vast majority, not surprisingly, fall into the category of only having a hybrid genome and there being no evidence for reproductive isolation. Very few of them actually are able to fulfill the case, the requirement of reproductive isolation, and only two of them actually can fulfill the three parameters. One of them is in plants, is Helianthus, and the second one is butterflies, is Helicalis butterflies. And in this particular case, you have parental one, parental two, Helicalis dominant and Helicalis single, and the two of them differ by the wing pattern, the colors of the bands. The hybrids actually have the two bands of the parentals, and interestingly and very important for this system, mating choice occurs based upon the pattern of the males. So in this particular case, you can see that if the males have a new combination of traits, the bands on the wings, the females are going to choose upon their own type and are going to be reproductively isolated from the two parentals. A couple of years ago, we got interested in studying three species in the Madagascar group: Drosophila simulans, Drosophila seychellii, and Drosophila mauritiana. And we collected Drosophila simulans and Drosophila seychellii. I was interested in a process called reinforcement, so I wanted to actually go to Seychelles and find out whether simulans and seychellii were hybridizing and whether natural selection was driving the evolution of reproductive isolation. So the goal was to collect simulans and collect seychellii on the different Seychelles islands. Seychelles is an archipelago that is off coast on the north of Madagascar. It's composed by 105 islands. Some of them, the vast majority of them, actually harbor Seychelles, and only a few of them have been reported to harbor Drosophila simulans. These species have been one of the cornerstones to study the evolution of reproductive isolation on Drosophila for many reasons. First, they are morphologically different, and you can identify them very readily, at least the males. For me, the males are very easy to identify in the field because they have very different genital morphology. If you look at the genital arches of simulans, they look like a sphere. Seychelles look like an elongated process, and the F1s look like an in-between between the two parentals. More importantly, there is reproductive isolation that occurs between the two species. There is very strong male discrimination. There is complete male sterility in the hybrids. So the F1 females are fertile, allowing for gene flow between them, but the F1's males are sterile. And with Julian A. Rawls, we actually did a survey to try to determine, just based on the morphological traits of males, whether we could identify Drosophila simulans, Escherichia hybrids. And we found that actually they hybridize rather frequently in some of the islands, especially where humans have been expanding in the last few years. So you find, for example, a lot of hybrids in Mahé, or in the Dingo, or in Prolin, and you don't find hybrids in the northern islands that are really far from the main centers of colonization. The other reason why this species has been fundamental for our study of adaptation in general is that this is one of the poster childs of adaptation genetics in Drosophila. Drosophila secharia is thought to be an especially from this particular fruit called Morinda citrifolia, commercially known as noni. It carries organic acids that are toxic for most species of Drosophila, particularly octanoid and capuric acid, also known as hexanoid. This is a photo taken in the field, and this is how you can actually purchase it. I purchase a bag, a couple of pounds of this per week. Natives in Seychelles know it as cheese fruit because it smells absolutely terrible. So it's something like every time that I get one of these boxes. When we went into the field, we were expecting that actually everything that was going to be green in Morinda was going to be Seychellia, and everything else in other fruits was going to be simulans if there was any simulans in there. We were surprised that actually we found a large proportion of Seychellia green in Morinda fruits, as is shown here. The error bars are shows the standard error across islands. But we also found it green in Seychellia green in other substrates, such as figs, bananas, and mangoes. This was a little bit surprising, but not too much. What we actually found surprising is that many of the Drosophila simulans that we found in the island were also found breeding in Morinda. But you just don't get by those. And the proportion was even higher than Seychelles. This was completely unexpected. We were expecting to find essentially the poster child of reproductive isolation. Seychellia breeds in Morinda. Simulans cannot get close to it, so they are reproductive isolated by these particular ecological limits, and that was not the case. So we brought back isogenal lines that are genetic stocks that are established out of like a single female to bring down to a lab and essentially propagate the progeny. I measured the resistance of these particular lines to the toxic components on the Morinda fruit. In this particular case, I am showing you the resistance to octanoid acid. You'll find that simulans around the world is essentially non-resistant. Seychelles is very resistant. Here you have the number of minutes that it takes for flies to fall to get knocked down when they are exposed to vaporized octanoid acid. After 20 minutes, we essentially have to stop the experiment because Seychelles might start dying out of like other factors like desiccation or just lack of food, but it's not because of the presence of octanoid acid. As you can tell, that the simulans like genotype that are the simulans that we collected in Morinda have sort of an intermediate phenotype and a lot of variation among them. We find similar patterns for other traits that are involved also in breeding to Morinda, like for example resistance to capuric acid, attraction to Morinda, and the variability to breed on Morinda. At this point we had a suspicion of the hypothesis that there has been gene flow between Seychellian and simulans, and that some of the alleles that allow Seychellia to breed in Morinda had migrated into simulans. So to do that, to actually assess this possibility, we got some genomic data. We got data from Morishana, from simulans, from other studies that have been published before us, by Dan Garrigan and by Peter Golfado and Kevin Torto's lab. We also got ourselves, we sequenced 27 simulans-like lines that are essentially the totality of the lines that we could collect in Seychelles. 20 lines of Seychelles that were collected in the northernmost island of Seychelles, where we have never seen the simulans or hybrids, with the expectation that this Seychellia would be the more pure species that we could get our hands on. the average coverage was 16x, and we proceeded to just do some essentially basic population analysis, trying to detect, for example, thick difference between Cyrillus and Seychellian, and trying to determine whether there has been gene flow and what particular chromosomes. I'm going to show you the story of autosomes and X chromosome apart, because they actually have differences in how admixture has occurred. So this is a story of, this is essentially the evolutionary history of autosomes for the Cyrillus group. You find that there is a lot of gene flow between Cyrillus and Mauritian, and between Seychellia, or between the ancestor of Seychellia, Mauritian, and Cyrillus. So there is gene flow going on in the group. This is a plot generated with Trinix, and essentially what it's showing, this is a change in genetic distances, and the Y chromosome doesn't really have any. It's just to project the tree. What is really interesting is that we actually find that there is gene flow between Seychellian into Cyrillus. Cyrillus that here appears to be close to Cyrillus from Madagascar and is receiving elements from Seychelles. Thus far, what I have told you is that Cyrillus have intermediate phenotypes from Cyrillus and Seychelles. So the question that we were actually asking here was whether Cyrillus line was reproductively isolated from the parameters. And the way to actually carry this experiment was a mating choice experiment, and in the extra layer that we actually set a Cyrillus like female, and we gave her the chance to choose between Cyrillus, Seychellia, and Cyrillus like. So essentially she did all the work. We just had to observe what male the female actually chose. And these are the results shown here in this chart. What you see is that the vast majority of the Cyrillus like females choose a Cyrillus like male. Over Cyrillus and over Seychellia. An important observation here is that for all these experiments, the Cyrillus-like males were different lines. They were not within the same isopinal lines, just to avoid same recognition within lines. So these Cyrillus-like females are actually reproductively isolated by behavioral differences from the other two species. And the same is also true for Cyrillus females. The Cyrillus females, the pure Cyrillus females from the continent, discriminate against Cyrillus-like males as well. One of the mechanisms that actually mating choice occurs in Drosophila is cuticular hydrocarbons. So we score essentially cuticular hydrocarbons. What was the composition of cuticular hydrocarbons? And what you see here is essentially is similar to a PCA. And you find that you see very clearly that actually Cyrillus and Seychellia are very different from each other. And what we observe is that Cyrillus like is also different from the parentals. It's sort of intermediate, but it's also probably it has accumulated some difference on its own, as it is predicted here by the canonical axis too. So is this a case of hybrid speciation? Let's go back to the criteria that Molly Schumer and collaborators proposed. Do they have a hybrid genome? It certainly looks like it, and there has been gene flow between Cyrillus and Seychellia and Cyrillus. Is there reproductive isolation with the parental species? Yes, there is, at least of the behavioral type. Did reproductive isolation originate through hybridization? We don't know that yet. So I am going to show you the attempts that we have done to actually bring down that hypothesis. But you will find out that the results are rather inconclusive. But we could actually definitely say that these hybrids are not really a hybrid swarm, because they are stable ecologically, and they are also reproductively isolated from the parentals. It's not a case of hybrid of adaptive progression, because these Cyrillus like a reproductive isolated to the two parental species. So the two possible scenarios that we have are hybrid speciation, where that Cyrillus like is sister to Cyrillus, split and actually accumulated reproductive isolated mechanisms, and has been receiving cis-shared material, but that cis-shared material has nothing to do with reproductive isolation. So the way to actually tell these two apart, and if anybody has any better ideas, I would love to hear them, because we have been a year and a half like actually thinking and rethinking. Is that hybrid speciation, you expect that there would be first reproductive isolation towards the two parental species, and that the mixed ancestry, that the admixture is actually involved in the origin of reproductive isolation. Something that doesn't occur, it has been allopathic speciation plus intervention. One of the ways to actually address these differences was to actually look what has introgressed from Seychelles to the Cyrillus back. You have here plots in the x-axis, you have the position
across two chromosomes, 2L and X. I'm just showing two, for example, even though if I wanted to be completely complete, for completeness, I should show six, but it would be really, really busy. And in the y-axis, you have the proportion of the sessile axis. And you can tell that there is variation. The 2L, there is essentially very lower than half across the whole chromosome, and there are some spikes. And in the X chromosome, you see that also there are some regions that are higher in sessile than just by chance. And I'm going to focus on those three particular lines, those three particular regions on the X chromosome for reasons that are going to become evident in a few slides. So let's look at the X chromosome. What we did first was actually look at these three regions that actually have high ancestry of Seychellia with regions that have been previously mapped to be known to be resistant, evolving more resistance to Morinda citrifolia in one way or the other. This one in particular overlaps the two of them. Overlap a high Seychellia region in the signal line and a region that has been ascribed to have resistance to Morinda. And that region contains this cluster of genes called corium proteins. That were actually described by Ian Rookin and Corinne Jones as being involved in resistance to octanoid acid and to Morinda citrifolia in 2009. And this is probably my favorite piece of data, because then we actually look at what do we know about reproductive isolation between Cimulus and Seychellia, and what regions have been ascribed to be related to the reproductive isolation between the two parental species. And we overlay them over these regions of high ancestry of Seychellia. And is what I'm showing you here. The black dots, I'm going to span this, I promise. The black dots are fixed differences between Cimulus and Seychellia, so we could actually keep track of them. One of them contains a gene called sex lethal that is essentially a switch for dimorphism in pretty much Drosophila species. It's one of the three genes, alleles known to actually regulate cuticular or hypothesize to regulate cuticular endocarpus between differences between Cimulus and Seychellia. That one is the one that was in the middle of the chromosome. And the other gene that was towards the end, the other region that has towards the end, contains this cluster of other binding proteins. One of them is actually OBP19A that is known to actually regulate pheromone perception in the social section, or highly hypothesized. Thus far, we had smoking guns, but actually that doesn't really connect. I mean, the fact that actually we have these two pieces of integration doesn't really connect and doesn't really explain whether actually they are related to reproductive isolation. We got our hands on to some classical genetic tools to try to replace the X chromosome from Drosophila simulants into the simulant like background. And we use this technique that is called attach X. It's two X chromosomes that are fused, are always inherited together. So when you cross a field that has an attach X to simulants like, and you do back process over time to males of simulant like, after 10 generations, what you're going to have is essentially a simulant, two simulant chromosomes that are fused to each other. So they're 100% simulants. And in average, the rest of the genome is going to be simulants. And what we find is that those simulants like that have those two X chromosomes together actually don't choose simulant like males, but actually choose simulant males over simulant like. And that one is shown. In no case, actually, they were for the Seychellia. For the Seychellia. So let's recap again. We have simulant-like simulants and Seychellia. There is reproductive isolation between the three of them, and there is some indication that actually the alleles that actually interact from Seychellia into the simulant background might be involved in reproductive isolation. Would I actually say that this is a punch and saying that actually reproductive isolation was caused by reproductive isolation? Absolutely not. We still don't have the evidence because we don't have the functional genetics to show that these particular integrations are involved into high-risk speciation. And that's why I bring back these two examples. It could be high-risk speciation, or it could be that actually simulant like is a very recently diverse simulant that is receiving material from Seychellia just because it's in Seychelles. I cannot disentangle these two. And at this point, this was deeply unsatisfying because I just couldn't get my answer to this. And at this point, I started thinking about what alternatives do we have to study hybrid speciation, because I am pretty convinced that this is a problem that anybody that is claiming that actually has identified hybrid species is going to have. This is not a trivial affair. And the answer came out from a paper in Yeast.
Tom Van Grieg and collaborators in 2001 published a paper in Science in which they actually took two species of geese, created hybrids. For the most part, these hybrids are sterile, but in 1% of the cases, they actually can produce progeny. What they did was to do multiple hybrid swarms of geese and assess which ones of these hybrid swarms were reproductive geese or electronegative. And they found that it's a very high proportion of them. I essentially did the same experiment with similar transition. The advantage of this experiment is that I knew exactly what I was starting. I was starting with a Simulus from Madagascar and a Seychelles from Belize. And I could create 400 hybrid swarms, and then I could measure reproductive isolation between these swarms and the actual lines that gave rise to them. And just to make it a little bit more realistic, this was carried in cages that also had Morillo citrifolia in them, just to mimic a little bit of what was going on in Seychelles. As every experiment of experimental evolution, this is limited by being in lab conditions, and it's going to be necessarily unrealistic. But at least, it's going to add us the possibility that actually hybrid species might arise through what, that species might arise through hybridization. And out of each of those hybrid swarms, out of those 400, we measure four traits: resistance to octanoid acid, resistance to hexanoid acid, preference for morinda, and female discrimination against the primate. The list of traits that I could have measured is much longer. I could have measured, for example, hybrid sterility or hybrid viability or male preference, but because of manpower, it was too underpaid for myself, we just have to actually be circumscribed to this group. And what we find is that there are plenty of hybrid swarms that actually evolve resistance to octanoid acid and resistance to hexanoid acid, not surprisingly given that the source of food was morinda. Many of them actually do the same, but there is a small proportion, about 3.5% shown here by this protein, that are resistant to octanoid acid, resistant to hexanoid acid, prefer morinda, and if you give them up, and why may they go for morinda, and also discriminate against the two parental species in favor of their own type. So essentially this protein, this 3.5%, actually fulfill the idea of a hybrid species. I don't know whether this is high or low. I'm not going to tell that this is a process that is rampant in nature and is occurring all the time. But what I'm trying to show with this experiment is that it's certainly possible. Now, important caveat here. This doesn't demonstrate that the hybrid swarms in nature are hybrid species by any stretch of the imagination. This is a different experiment, and we simply don't know how hybridization play out in the field. But what we know is that it's certainly possible. I was interested in hybrid speciation as a whole, and I was interested in it in the terms of how different factors in the genome between the parental species are going to affect the evolution of hybrid species, right? So one of the ideas that actually I had at the time is that depending on how diverse the hybrid, the parentals are when they are hybridizing, that might affect the high likelihood of hybrid speciation. The experiment that I just showed you before, Simulus and Seychellia, diverged about 0.2, 0.3 million years ago. What happens if you, for example, have more diverse species? And the second possibility and the second factor that I was interested in is what happens when you have chromosomal rearrangements between the parental species. Simulans and Seychelles are largely collinear, at least from what we can detect from chromosomal squashes, but we simply don't know how a chromosomal arrangement would affect the likelihood of hybrid speciation. So essentially the experiment is very simple. To generate one of these hybrid swarms, you take the two parentals, you produce F ones, mix them together, and put the two parentals, the males of the two parentals, so there are essentially a bunch of genotypes in a cage, and you repeat this over and over. You actually have enough recombination and enough samples, you expect that there is going to be a mixture, and that there is going to be recombination breaking down to like particular gene combinations, and of these unmixed individuals, you can actually measure the reproductive isolation from the I did this for as 22 species pairs that cover a large phylogenetic span. And if you think about one of these parents, each hybrid swarm, and you actually split them towards the parental species, there are four possible outcomes. The first one is that the hybrid female simply doesn't want to, that is behaviorally, that is reproductively, that is behaviorally sterile. And that happens. In some cases, it doesn't really matter how hard a male tries, the female just doesn't accept any kind of male. Or it takes a very long time to accept the male. The second possibility is that the female prefers to mate with only one of the parents. So in that case, the expectation is that possibly one of the genomes is just getting purged really quickly, and it's essentially regressing to one of the parental species. The second possibility is that the female discriminates against hybrids, but mates with either parental species. This is what happens, for example, when you have F1 females in Drosophila. F1 females are particularly promiscuous and accept either parental or single. And the fourth possibility is that a female prefers only to mate with the hybrids. For the sake of this experiment, we just focus on possibilities 2 to 4, because behavioralists, there were not there what we were looking for. They're also kind of boring. So here we have a list of 10 to 22 species that we did for this experiment by Ying Tong. Really recently diverged, like less than 4.1 million years ago, to very diverge between Melanogaster and Simulans. This is a particular cross that shouldn't go, but in some cases you can actually get a mutant of Simulans that can, in some rare instances, produce hybrid females that are fertile with Melanogaster, so you can actually perpetuate this. This particular trick has also been used very cleverly to generate introversion, for example, of the mitochondria of Simulans into Melanogaster. And it's extremely, extremely divergent. So what I'm going to show you next is essentially it's kind of a regression, but it's not. But what happens in terms of, in the x-axis, you have a divergence between the parental species, between 0 and 25 million years old. And in the y-axis, you have the proportion of hybrid swarms that are reproductively isolated with the parentals. And okay, for each experiment, for each of these hybrid swarms, we did 100 just because we are hoping to get funding to do more per swarm, but for now we just have to do 100. And what I fitted here was just a cubic spike. It doesn't really have any particular function. And you can tell that if the species are really, really decently diverged, for example, one million years, they collapse into a single entity, and there is really no hybrid swarms that show reproductive isolation towards the parent. But if you have the same, of course, if you have really diverse species, so they actually just choose, what occurs in this particular case is that they choose one of the parentals, for example, in the Melanogaster Simulans, they regress to Melanogaster. I don't understand the molecular mechanisms of this or the genetic mechanism, but that's the observation that we have. And at the end, essentially the proportion of hybrid swarms that are reproductively isolated is very low as well. Let's say here. What is interesting is what happens in this area of moderate divergence, like around 500,000. In this particular case, there is a high proportion of swarms that is reproductively isolated from the parental. I don't understand why. I don't know whether there is a particular genetic divergence that is more permissive for actually behavior to evolve and to actually become more reproductively isolated to parentals, or what is going on, but the observation is rather clear. Again, there is caveats in this experiment. For example, this divergence between parental species is essentially calibrated with a molecular clock, which is less than ideal, and very soon we are hoping to actually get genomic awareness to calculate molecular divergence in a more systematic way. The second kind of experiment that we did was to try to determine how inversions could affect the likelihood of hybrid speciation. We knew that in some cases, as I showed you before, hybrid swarms that are reproductively isolated from the parentals might arise. What happens, for example, if you have these lines, for example, this Antonia line and this Jacoba line that are collinear, to create the same hybrid swarms, and compare it to Santomea lines, and the Jacoba lines that have a few inversions between them. That's what these pairs are showing. They are essentially the same thing, the same pairs of species. But the only difference between the odd and even lines is that the second one has inversions and the first one does not have inversions. And that's what is shown here. These are four plots that actually show pretty much the same as before, three pairs of species, the proportion of reproductively isolated swarms. The white ones are swarms that actually had inversions, the black ones are swarms that have no inversions, and essentially the four panels are just different levels of a statistical significance. A lot of odds ratio that is 3.5 to 5.5, and of course if the higher the odds ratio, the less likely that we would classify one of these swarms as a hybrid species, just because the cutoff is just going to be much, much harsher. And you can tell that in all cases, the cases that the swarms that have inversions actually develop more hybrid swarms that are reproductively isolated to the parentals than those that are not, that don't have inversions among them. So this experiment that I just showed you essentially have a very clear message. First one is that genetic divergence really matters in terms of the likelihood of hybrid speciation. And that there are, it's just that I don't, still don't understand the mechanisms, but that there is a particular age in which the parentals have diverged, that hybrid speciation is more likely than other ages. Again, this doesn't mean that I am arguing that this is a common process. This is a very controlled setting in which I am actually manipulating where we start and where we end and how we measure reproductive isolation and what, and we define very clearly what is our hybrid species. But the possibility is there. And the second conclusion is that actually chromosomal rearrangements might also have a role. If you have two parental species that have inversions among them, they are more likely to actually develop hybrid speciation when they actually produce hybrid swarms than species that are polygamous. I want to just finalize, acknowledging the people that have done most of the work. Juliana Rolls actually went with me to the field to collect all these flies, and actually he has an uncanny ability to find flies in strange places. Shyam and Molly were essentially the driving force, the analytical driving force of the first part of the project, because they are the ones that actually, Shyam wrote all the code, and Molly is very, very clear in her mind on how actually she analyzed the data, which was a tremendously great fact. And other people that have been involved in the project, and I hope to have tons and tons of questions and comments. Thank you very much. Of the size of the introgressions, you can try to like essentially work this as a molecular clock, just assuming that there is a number of recombination events every generation, right? We couldn't do that, because when the way that we try to actually identify the haplotypes, there is a lot of ancestral polymorphism, and also there is a lot of high-frequency alleles in singles that are also present in the but at low frequency. We don't know whether this is introgression or not. So for this particular project, we had to focus on just fixed alleles, on fixed differences. So for that part, you get a difference, a difference, a difference, but you get sort of like a very rough approximation of the size, but you don't know how large really progressions are. But that's something that I really would like to do, try to find out how long ago it was and what was the original population size of this. We try to use HapMix, but because we don't have the recombination map for simulants or for Seychellia, and since they are different in the recombination rates, we just couldn't do it. But that was the gold standard that we were looking for. Towards Seychellia? Mm-hmm. So when I actually wrote this place, I thought that it was a case of reinforcement, because sim-like discriminates very strongly against Seychellia, much stronger than similar from the continent. So I was like, wow, it's sympathetic with Seychellia, they are discriminating stronger, reinforcement. I don't know whether that is the case, and I don't have evidence for that. But it seems like are very discriminate very strongly against Seychellia, much more than the
sim-like females, you refer to it as reproductive isolation. I mean, I saw a sort of mating there, but a fourth of all the matings of those females were with non-simulans-like males. And so that doesn't, if I remember the pie chart, that raises questions about the persistence, the collective persistence of these genotypes over time.
Absolutely. So these phenotypes were measured several generations apart, just to make sure. So what Dave is actually bringing out is that you bring some flies that actually have a ceratic mate in the field, and you let them in the lab, they might actually change their preference, right?
Well, I'm just thinking about the fly chart itself. I mean, three-fourths of it was red, simulines by mating preference, and then, you know, roughly a fourth of all the matings were non-simulite male simulants. It seems like there's a lot of opportunity for the swamping of these genotypes.
Oh, it's true. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not arguing that reproductive isolation is complete. Let me just pull the file chart. This one, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not arguing that reproductive isolation is complete. Because, I mean, but in the species, it is. I mean, even for really good species, it is. It is true. I mean, if you probably leave similar ligands and similar in a single vial, just to interbreed for a very long time, they are going to merge into a single population. That's certainly a possibility.
And the simulate females, the simulate strains all originated from the Miranda fruit.
Yes, they were collected by netting.
So there would be a higher frequency of alleles associated with resistance to Miranda. And the simulate flies were also observed on other resources or not?
Rarely. They were?
They were.
But they were rarely. For the one that actually we included, so at some point we had to make a call on what we would call sim-like. And what we call sim-like is stuff that, flies that were collected on Marine, breeding, well, at least resting on Marine, caught with an end Marine, and show this particular pattern. There is similar flies in Seychelles, but that we think is pure sim. That are not resistant to Marine and actually behave like cosmopolitan simulants. So they are essentially in the same localities, sim-like and simulants, but not in the same fields.
So the flies that you sequenced, there were how many generations were moved from the field?
Say that again.
How many generations were moved from the field and the flies that you actually
Three generations.
Three?
Yeah, because we tried to avoid, because of other projects that I had in the past, we tried to avoid inbreeding as much as possible because the colors of the snips actually have a lot of trouble with that. So we just put them in the sequencer, like we froze them, and as soon as we found this out, essentially they were a strength of the sequence.
I may have lost the thread somewhere here, but back at the start where you were first talking about the hybrids between simulants and Seychellensis. You said that in the hybrids, the females were fertile, the males were sterile.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. So, but later on, I thought you said that the mating success with the hybrid males was 1%. That 1% of them were successful. Is that correct, or did I miss something?
Maybe I didn't speak clearly. So, simulants, if you grow simulants as a Seychellia, 50% of the individuals of the F1s are fertile, and all of them are females.
Of the females?
The females, 100% of them are fertile.
And the males?
Completely sterile, 100% sterile.
Sterile, okay. So correct there, but
I know where. So what I was saying is that in some, like for the yeast experiment that I base my experiment on, when you cross those two yeast species, there is some rare instances in which 1% of the hybrids of yeast.
Oh, it's the yeast species, okay. But here in your strong female choice, if they're selecting, if they're mating with the sterile males.
The sim-like are completely fertile.
The sim-like are completely fertile.
So they are hybrids, but they are advanced. We think that they are advanced intercross. They're not F1s.
You mentioned the particular hydrocarbons early on. I think those are sex pheromones, then, correct?
Yeah.
Don't these insects also have aggregation pheromones? And if so, do they play a role in hybrid species?
That's a really good question, and I don't know. I don't know whether there is aggregation pheromones in Drosophila. Anybody, Drosophila people here know?
I honestly have a second layer of behavioral chemistry.
I think that it would be really interesting to look at, and honestly, I just haven't never even thought about that. So I am going to go home and read about it. Thank you.
So I'm curious about the ecological isolation. So these guys meet on the fruit? Is that?
Seychelia does. Similans, we thought that it did. Well, again, the simulants that we found in the fluidical will seem like whatever.
Right.
I'm certainly not going to go into taxonomic differences here because I don't think we are at that stage of growing
forever. Okay. So do you know if the sim-like mate on the fruit or not?
I have done some experiments in which I actually have measured. So you put simulants in fresh moringa. They don't mate because they are just so hot. Even with their own type. They just don't mate. They're pretty much left there to die. Seychelia is perfectly happy. Seem like actually mates me.
I'm doing well. So it seems like the sim like, if I'm remembering this right, have kind of intermediate tolerance for the morinda fruit. But it seems like given long enough, you would expect them to be outcompeted then by Seychelia.
Seychelles has an extra characteristic, and is that it lives extremely few years. It's a species that is has large eggs and very, very few.
Is that a trade-off? I don't know
whether how the fact that actually Seychelles lives is related to the specialization. I don't know. Look at the ovarials of the sim-like and they're like siblings. They're not like siblings. The difference between siblings and siblings is very slight. And the sim-like you can see.
You didn't say anything about the sim-like male genitalia at all.
Simulants.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a main surprise that actually, because when I brought females from Seychelles, from Morinda, I was convinced that they were Seychelles. And I started raising days of female lines. And they had a male genitalia of simulants. And at that point, I was very positive, and that's why I went and served to the simulants.
If there are no more questions,
thank you very much.